This week's show is sponsored by Telari, innovator and SD-WAN leader that offers a thinking WAN solution that proactively manages your network capacity, the reliability and performance so that you don't have to. Self-correcting and brilliant, Telari's solution frees IT administrators to innovate in a new areas of their network. Discover a better way to SD-WAN at Telari.com. This is the Packet Pushers Podcast, a place where more than 30 years of networking hasn't gathered any dust, just a pile of unpaid invoices that are technical debt, and we're trying to work out if the creditors are coming to collect this quarter. Today is a unique show. I've been thinking for some time that I'd like to conduct more interview sessions with people or figures in the industry that you would know and to talk about what they feel the future of the networking will look like. So on the call today, we have Douglas Kummer, who is a distinguished professor from Purdue University and a very well-known author. Welcome to the show, Douglas.
Thank you.
Do you want to tell people a little bit about some of the things that you've done and why I'd be talking to you?
Well, let's see. I started out back in the 1970s, before most people even knew about the internet. I worked on the internet project when it was a research project. And so I was there right at the beginning. I know all the guys. They're all my friends. And what can I say?
And 50 years later, you're still at it.
I'm still at it. By the 1980s, I realized that there was a reason I should write a book about it, that it was actually going to take off. And so I wrote volume one of the Internet Working series, and it took off. And I've been a member of the research community ever since. I spent 6 years at Cisco. I was VP of research there, trying to lead research for Cisco, a big networking vendor.
So you've pretty much seen it all, done it all, or made it all.
Yeah,
I guess
I've seen it all. So now I'm an old curmudgeon.
I'm a middle-aged curmudgeon. I'll wear that badge with pride. What we wanted to do is, I met you at a conference, and we happened to be sitting at the same table. Getting some lunch, and I overheard a conversation between you and Dimitri Stiliadis about sort of where are we with networking today and what does it look like tomorrow. So what I would like to do is talk to you around the future of networking and how you see the industry or people or technology developing, and just sort of kick it off. So here's a question that's on my mind right now, which is routing protocols. Today we have protocols like BGP, ISIS, and OSPF that are being used to build the networks of today. Now, there's a couple of questions around there. Are autonomous routing protocols fit for purpose for the next 10 years? And can they scale? We know that BGP scales to the internet, but we also know that there's things like TCAMs and propagation performance and things like that. Have you got a view there?
Okay, so let's start with a few facts. If you want to talk about BGP, which is really the glue that holds the whole internet together, the first thing that everybody has to understand is that at the center of the internet, routing is not based on shortest paths. Now, that comes as a shock to most technical people. It's based on least dollars. If you want to read some fun stuff, go read the notes by Bill Norton at Equinix on how ISPs play games to use BGP in ways that technical people wouldn't even imagine. For example, suppose it costs me a lot to take your traffic. Here's what I do. I advertise a route to some destination that you're using, but I put you on the path. Using BGP, you can do that. It's not part of the protocol. It's not something that normal technical people would think of. But I put your autonomous system on the path, and I advertise it back to you. Your BGP, following the standard protocol rules, will look at that and say, aha, I better not send things that way. It's a routing loop. It's going to come back to me. So I can avoid getting stuff from you just by faking up my advertisements. And that's what goes on at the center of the internet. So when you think about routing at the center of the internet, remember it's about dollars, not about shortest paths.
It's about the business policy, not about the best way or the shortest way or the, or even getting the traffic there in the fastest, lowest latency path.
Right. The second thing you have to understand about routing in the internet is that we don't do routing at the center of the internet. Big ISPs don't really want to tell anyone their costs. That is to say, how many hops or latency or throughput or whatever about their networks, the things that routing protocols normally advertise. So BGP is technically not a routing protocol. Technically, it's a reachability protocol. ISP number one advertises, I can reach these destinations to ISP number two. It doesn't say, I can reach these destinations, and by the way, this one is four hops from me, and this one's two hops, and it doesn't do that. In fact, there are technical reasons why you can't do that. You can read my books and find out about it. But that's something to keep in mind when you think about protocols and in routing. That, you know, we, the technical community, tend to think about all these wonderful algorithms that have been developed to compute shortest paths, and sorry, that's not what's really going on.
So it is within, and this is where I get this vision of the future of networking. The gap between service provider and enterprise has converged in the last decade, and the two technologies are sort of very similar, MPLS, for example. And then what we're seeing is this divergence again as service provider goes off to fork into high bandwidth, low complexity, and the enterprise is going off in a completely different direction. Is that a fair assumption?
The enterprises, the large enterprises, are using some of the same technologies that ISPs are using. But ISPs have an entirely different economic model. For example, an ISP, if you think about BGP, BGP came along and has this notion of transit traffic. An ISP has to deal with transit traffic because it's carrying packets on behalf of other people. So I'm an ISP in the center of the internet. Maybe there's some guy in China talking to some guy in England, and I happen to be carrying the packets. They are transit. But if you're an enterprise, it's really all your traffic. It may be going out to the internet. Mm-hmm. It may be coming in from the internet, but one end or the other or both are really for you. So it's entirely different. I know that some of the technologies get used, but the economics is completely different.
And does that drive the technology decisions on the ground as well?
It drives how people use the technology. That's certainly true. Mm. When you talk to ISPs especially, they are interested in how can I don't want to say misuse, but how can I stretch this technology to make more bucks? Mm. What can I do that stretches it to make more dollars? Well, and by the way, you asked about scaling, and that's another difference between enterprises and ISPs. ISPs have to deal with the scale of the internet, whereas enterprises only have to deal with their own scale. And an enterprise sort of has a better handle on whether they're going to, for example, expand by acquisition or by merger. You know, they have that to planning business. ISPs...
Well, enterprises are smaller, so they sort of have a better vision of where they're going. Whereas, as you say, ISPs don't necessarily control the endpoints, so they don't know, they can't control bandwidth inside their networks.
Well, easy for you to say that enterprises are smaller, but that's a hasty generalization. I happen to know a guy who manages the sixth largest network in the world. It is not an ISP. Yep. It is an enterprise. In any case, so let's talk about scaling. Let's get back to that.
Yeah.
Here's the good news. Scaling routing protocols is easy. That's because routing can take a long time to gather and check routes, and you can take as long as you can need as you need in computer terms to pre-compute failure modes. That is to say, you can compute what routes would be used if link number 76 fails in your network? How would everything change? You can pre-compute. And then all you have to do is tell all the routers, 76 just failed. They've already got everything pre-computed. Bingo. They switch over. That part, the routing part, is easy. You also mentioned things like TCAMs. That's forwarding. That's the day-to-day, packet-to-packet, you know, we're going millisecond-to-millisecond, here comes a packet, packet goes out, here comes a packet goes out. That's forwarding, and that is the hard part. As speeds go up, as we get to, you know, we're at 10 gigabits per second going to 40 and 100, When you get to 100 gigabits per second, the numbers are staggering. Mm. Even at 10 gigabits per second, if you're a hardware designer, here's the problem. If you get back-to-back packets, and by the way, the hardware is always designed, worst case, to handle back-to-back packets. If you get back-to-back packets at 10 gigabits per second, the smallest packets in the internet, you have 45 nanoseconds to make a forwarding decision before the next packet arrives. Mm-hmm. Now, let's put that in perspective. How long does it take to access a typical DRAM memory?
It's hundreds of nanoseconds.
No, you can get it if you buy a really expensive memory. You can get it down to 10 to 12 nanoseconds per memory access. Really expensive stuff. That means you get 3 memory accesses to do forwarding. So you can't just put a packet in memory, pick up the Ethernet type and find out that, yeah, indeed, it's IP, and then pick up the destination address, then go take that and look up in a routing table that may require some, you know, 4 or 5 accesses. You can't do that.
That's true, because you do multiple lookups on a packet these days. As you say, you have to take the Ether type to establish it. Today, of course, there's only 2 protocols, IPv4 and IPv6. And then you have to establish, do a lookup on the IP header, and then you may have to do more lookups deeper into the packet as well.
Yeah, so you can't do that sort of stuff at all. That's why all of the high-end routers rely on ASICs, large special-purpose memories, pipelining, and parallelism. Hmm. So it's all hardware. So if you want to scale up forwarding, you have to talk to the hardware guys. If you want to scale up routing, that's actually pretty easy.
So you're talking, in terms of scaling with pre-computed failure modes, you're talking about technologies like loop-free alternate and MPLSTE and so forth. Am I correct on that assumption?
Yes, MPLSTE is one. Well, MPLS sort of was the first time that people thought about, hey, how can we do fast failover? Various other groups had done fast failover routes, but MPLS made it, I don't know, commercially acceptable. It wasn't just a research thing anymore. It was commercially acceptable. So, but yeah, that's the sort of thing we do. We can apply that same idea, not the same details, but the same idea to all routing.
So let me ask you a question. We know that you've heard, of course, about software-defined networking and all the different mess that we're currently in about selecting the right way out of SDN. You know, I see SDN as we're in the early phases. There's dozens of different ideas going around. And eventually, I think the market will converge around one or two fundamental ways. In the same way that 30 years ago, we converged around RIP and then OSPF and so forth. Over the years, we evolve as things change. What we're seeing, a lot of people using BGP as an SDN system. So they use programmatic control of the BGP instance to distribute state around the network. So you're talking about it being a reachability protocol in terms of service providers, but we're also seeing, you know, products like Juniper's Open Contrail or Project Calico or even Cisco's using ISIS as a database clustering mechanism to distribute state around its SDN strategy. Does that make sense to you?
Well, the first time I heard about that was about 10 years ago. Some researchers said, hey, you know, we've got these routing protocols, and what they really do is they pass around addresses. But what's an address? It's just a bit string. We can put anything you want in that bit string and pass it around. Wouldn't that be great? And this happens in computer science again and again and again. There are so many things that come back to the following observation. Underneath, it's all just bits. And as long as it's just bits, you can pass any kind of semantic information you want just by encoding it in bits. So, yeah, you can do that. But these routing protocols, things like OSPF, I know that's one of the hot ones, is really designed not for passing around a distributed database or, you know, convergence of a distributed data. It's really designed for doing routing. And what you gain and what you lose, well, you gain the fact that, for example, I won't mention any specific companies, but let's just say large networking vendors already have OSPF. They already have BGP. They're already doing all that. if they can get people to use the bits in those protocols to do other things, they don't have to do anything new. Mm. It's just, they just sell more of what they're selling. But, you know, they're not selling distributed databases, so they don't want to compete with Oracle. They don't want to actually go to the work of building a distributed database system. If you go over to Oracle, Oracle will tell you why their distributed database system handles things like failure, for example, much better than OSPF would. OSPF as a database distribution mechanism is, I don't know, amateurish at best.
Because it's eventual convergence. It's not consistent. It's eventually consistent. And, you know, when I look at, you know, BGP, the same thing, there's no guarantees that the data is actually is propagated accurately.
Yes. I mean, there's no, so there's no consensus. There's no, there's none of the things that the database community
is famous feedback for. Loops. Like, I'm a big believer in feedback loops. And I think it's fundamental computer science to understand that if you do something, you must be able to validate that something happened. Some people call that testing. I see it as more fundamental engineering. And if I put, if I inject a root into any routing protocol, or and when I say root, I'm also talking about a data record, I rely on that protocol to propagate that across the network. I've got no way of testing that it actually reached every point in the network.
Yes. And you don't even have a way to test. The really bad news is you don't have a way to test which version of a change happens. So, for example, you stick something in and then you stick something else in. You assume, if you're like most people, that if you stick in A, it goes out. Then you stick in B and it goes out. But routing protocols have a funny property that they don't have labels to say this came first. It's just data. So what happens is you can end up with, suppose A gets lost at some point, you know, lightning hits a line, a packet gets lost, A doesn't propagate, then B propagates, but then some other router wakes up and propagates A again, and you get A after B. Those kinds of things. Routing protocols just don't handle all of the normal things that a database system
does. They were designed for CPU, and in an era when CPU and memory was short, you know, we didn't have any.
Well, no, because they're designed, they don't, in a routing system, you don't need all of the properties that a database system guarantees you. For example,
because it's not a database, I guess.
It's not a bit, look, if I have a bank account, I want to make sure that deposits and withdrawals are done exactly. Mm-hmm. You know? I need a database. Routing, suppose that for a while, you know, the wrong route gets in. Some packets get lost. It'll get corrected. Everything works out. You don't want to pay the price of stopping the internet, making sure that everybody agrees on all the routes, and then starting the internet again. And that's basically what a distributed database has to do. Right? It has to block subsequent transactions while until one of them is applied. So we can't do that in the internet. Routing protocols do a different thing. They're not designed to be a database. There's no need for it.
Yeah. So I guess, I mean, and this is what I've been wrestling with people using BGP as an SDN protocol and saying, oh, we'll just program it into BGP. And I've often wrestled with that because I conceptually agree with what you, everything that you've said. But it's nice to have some validation that I'm not completely off my rocker. It seems obvious to me, right, that these databases are eventually consistent. There's no record locking. There's no validation. You know, when you make a change, there's no validation that the record was replicated into the neighboring database.
Yeah, or even that K out of N database copies got it. The other thing that database systems give you, distributed databases, is you say, I want to have at least three copies of this out there. You make a change, and the system verifies that at least K out of N, whatever you specify, you have N servers, at least three of my servers got this. So I know it's safe.
Yeah, that would call that a feedback loop again. I would get a signal back saying my data is safe in one form or another. Therefore, I can now continue on with operation. I mean, I know that routing protocols make perfect sense, especially in the era of limited CPU and limited memory, when we needed to have protocols that were very simple, very low CPU usage. And ultimately, networking was very simple. 10 years ago, 20 years ago, our networks were rather small, thousands of devices. And now we're talking about the rise of the Internet of Things, where endpoints are going to increase to phenomenal numbers, billions of devices. And that's going to drive up the number of network devices in the Internet particularly. I just do wonder if routing protocols are actually ready to handle this and the reliability that they come with.
Yep. You know? Well, okay. Yep. You have to remember that routing protocols, the way we do routing is to base it on networks, not on endpoints. So if I have a million little tiny sensors connected to a network, then all the routing protocols in the internet need to know is that there's one network out there. So you do have to keep in mind that routing does not scale proportional to the number of endpoints. It scales proportional to the number of networks, and networks can be aggregated. For example, in IPv6, we have three levels of aggregation. So at the center of the internet, you only have to advertise the major top level routes. You don't have to advertise even all the way down to the low level networks. For example, Purdue University can get a single IPv6 prefix. It can divide it up into lots of networks inside the university. But outside, there's only one prefix that needs to be advertised.
Yeah, so you're talking about a /32, and then you have a /64 internal, a /48, and you have a /16, /64 internally.
And, you know, you can divide that up however you like among a million little endpoint nodes. So we could have sensors all over campus. They all connect through that one network route outside.
I guess this is where overlay networking comes in. I've talked with a number of IoT companies, in particular companies who make networking software for IoT, and a lot of them are building overlay networks where the endpoint, like a smartphone or a smartwatch or something like that, will use a tunneling protocol to connect back to cloud nodes. Well, at that point, the intermediate network where the routing protocols exist doesn't need to know about the overlay. The overlay is transparent to that.
Yes. I mean, that was one of the major design points of the internet was end-to-end connections. And what we found is that most people would rather have cheap than end-to-end, so we don't need to give and advertise end-to-end connections everywhere. We can build overlays. We can build the SDN folks are building overlays like crazy at layer two. You don't even have to do it at layer three.
Doing it at layer two is dying away, and people are moving to do it over layer three. So I'm seeing a rise of startups, particularly in the software-defined WAN space, using overlay networks to bypass the concept of redundant paths out to head office. So instead of having, you know, native IP routing from branch office, you know, maybe you'll have two MPLS connections and an internet to just load balance across all three using an overlay.
All right. That, yes, you can do that with an overlay. And as soon as anybody says, I'm going to have, MPLS, the next word out of their mouth is, this is really an overlay. So overlay is an idea. And yes, MPLS is an overlay. You know, OpenFlow does layer two overlays. Everything is an overlay in that sense. But at some level, it's all just packet routing. So we have three potential routes, two MPLS paths and the internet, and we're doing load balancing by just, balancing across three paths. Anyway, two people do keep talking about overlays, and I understand that's a really hot sort of marketing term.
Well, and that's what I'm trying to understand, is that, is overlays the long-term trend, or are we likely to see, like, for example, a protocol like Lisp or ILNMP, where they actually start to disassociate the device identifier from the network itself? So although the network might have a physical underlying address, the actual endpoint addressing would be separate from the network itself. And that's where, Lisp and ILNMP comes from. Then overlays become less relevant, or if that gets widely adopted.
Well, overlays become less relevant because we have with Lisp or with any of those technologies, we have incorporated the notion of overlays into the internet. So yeah, they become less relevant in a sense. They become they become completely relevant in another sense because that's all we have.
Yeah.
But people have been trying to do that for years. In fact, way back in the early days of the internet, there was a big question. Should we have an address identify an endpoint, or should we have an address identify a network connection? And the internet guys thought about it long and hard. There were other protocols around. I guess you realized that the internet didn't just, win by becoming the only one. There were lots of people who built protocols in which the addresses were endpoint identifiers, not network connection identifiers. Yeah. And the original Apple Talk and a whole bunch. But what happened was the internet grew up to be gigantic. And when you get to gigantic, there's a really great advantage in having network connections. That's the routing thing that we talked about. You only have to pass around routes for networks, not for endpoints. In fact, if you want to see something really staggering, try and imagine doing a routing protocol with some flat addressing scheme. Let's take MAC addresses. Every computer has a unique MAC address. Let's use that. Suppose that every time you connected your device to the internet, you had to route by saying, I'm going to use my MAC address as the IP address. It's a 48-bit unique number, so I'll use that as my IP address. And there won't be any prefix. It'll just be that. Now, that means all the routing protocols have to pass around those addresses for endpoints. Now imagine the Internet of Things. Millions and millions of little tiny things coming and going because, you know, there can be a sensor on the top of a bus that's running around a city. Every time it attaches to the network somewhere else, you'd have to pass around new routing information.
You'd have to pass around a database of endpoint identifiers as well as a database of networks.
Yes. No, you wouldn't have to pass around networks. You have to pass around endpoint identifiers.
Yes, of course. Yeah.
Just that much alone is enough. It's enough to kill you.
Is that still applicable today, do you think? Could we decouple the endpoint identifier from the network?
If we decouple endpoint from the network, we end up with this horrible problem of passing around endpoint addresses. So that's what Lisp does. In fact, that's what Trill, all those technologies do. They have a pair. They admit that you need to have both. Let's have a pair. Let's have a unique endpoint identifier and a network to which it's currently connected. We can do routing based on the network. We can do so. It's really just a grown-up version of the IP addressing scheme that separates things into prefix and suffix. There's a little bit more sophistication to it, but that's the basic idea. You have to have some way to do aggregation of routes.
I guess that's where this recent EVPN standard that everybody's getting excited about, where they're publishing MAC addresses into BGP, and then so that you can do layer 2 over MPLS. But because you're publishing the MAC addresses, you don't get the looping problems that you would normally get with, you know, things like EO, MPLS and so forth. That works because only a certain number of endpoints are holding the MAC tables. You're not holding every MAC table in the world. Yeah.
So the other thing you have to understand is when you talk about MPLS, MPLS is configured. And when you think about short-term, you know, little MPLS connections across a campus, it's easy to configure. You can pass around arbitrary information because, after all, it's pretty small. When you think about an MPLS connection that crosses continents, many ISPs, if everybody along the path has to know all of the MAC addresses of everybody, that can start to chew up bandwidth.
Oh, you're talking about the propagation of routing information becomes significant in its own right. Yeah.
Yeah. And you have to understand the other side of this. Remember that companies do not build things to do good for the world. They build things to make money. And one of the things you always have to ask yourself is when ISPs jump on a technology, why is it that that technology always uses more bandwidth, which is what they charge for? Well, they're out to make money. So, yeah, they push the technologies that use the most bandwidth. It's just a funny, it's a funny situation where they are ready to adopt anything that's going to guarantee lots more dollars in their pocket, independent of whether that's a good use of the network or anything.
Nothing's inherently bad. It's the old story, guns don't kill people, people kill people. Networking protocols don't break networks, people break networks.
No, networking protocols don't make money, companies make money. I don't know, something.
We could keep going all day on sounds interesting. It's like, and I know we got BGP today and we're going to be stuck with it because yeah, everybody's got it and there doesn't seem to be any will amongst the networking community to sort of like modernize into something else. But are there new alternatives to routing protocols that we could look at? Like, for example, this week I was looking at BIER, which is the bit index explicit replication, which is a way to avoid having multicast in your core while letting it pass through looking like it's actual normal multicast. Is there things like that that are going to change the way routing protocols look?
Well, in the big sense, no. We know what the fundamental algorithms are. People in the algorithms community have been looking at algorithms for routing protocols for a long time. Nothing fundamentally new has come out of that. Now, in the engineering sense, you could redesign some of the protocols in ways that would have a different representation, but it wouldn't be fundamentally different. Now, when you wander into multicast, that's a whole nother ball of wax. That's one of those things that I count as one of the mistakes of the internet. The way multicast was defined, IP multicast, is absolutely horrid. It's why no one has ever used it, really. You know, it's totally general. You can form a multicast group at any time with whomever you want, and then the internet is supposed to figure out how to, you know, pass that routing information around. And then it gets worse. Anybody, any individual, anywhere can join or leave a multicast group, an IP multicast group, at any time. So I start a multicast group at Purdue University. And then some guy in China decides to join. And then some guy in Europe decides. You know, it goes on and on and on. But they can leave at any time. And of course, when they leave, there's really no point. You don't want routing protocols to send a copy of the packets from the multicast group all the way to them and then have them thrown
actually,
away.
I care less today about multicast than I ever have because I don't think there's too many use cases left in the world where only one source talks to many endpoints. The overwhelming use case for everything is many to many. The one use case that multicast has always been on about is the idea of streaming video. So there's only one source. But the reality is that Netflix doesn't have one source. It's on demand. So there's never one source. And the second part is that the internet compensated for the bandwidth by deploying content delivery networks. So even if there's 1,000 people with 1,000 different streams, they're not all streaming from one source. They're all streaming from something at the end of their street at their nearest pop.
Yeah, so let's remember that multicast is used down the street. So you put the little pop or whatever it is, the curbside box, and on a corner somewhere, and it's got the content. Maybe it's a movie that's hot, or maybe it's a recording of a sports event that's hot. You put it down there, and then when many people on the street want to see it, you can do multicast to their boxes.
Yeah, but they don't watch it at the same time. It's not like it's the 1960s when everybody watches the same show at Friday night at 6 o'clock.
No, but you can still multicast it down. If more than one person is watching, you can multicast the whole thing and avoid having two copies. Then if you're three people.
My point is that no one watches the same thing at the same time because we all time shift. Like even if I'm here in the UK, the BBC plays all of its television free to air over a thing called an iPlayer, which is a their web streaming service. I could be watching television, but then I can just press pause, walk off, get a glass of water, check the cats are fed, then come back and restart it. So even if I was watching it at the same time as everybody else, I can just press pause and then continue. It'll pick up where I left it.
Sure. So let's forget movies. Let's go on to sports events.
No one cares about that either. They all stream that unicast because there's no multicast in a CDN network.
No, there's no multicast in the CDN network. But, for example, they're streaming. They get down to the local town pop in some small town somewhere. And then the town can do multicast down the streets to the people that are watching.
Okay. And then the pop goes out. Where's the failover?
Well, it's a small town.
It's a major problem then because all of a sudden you've got the multicast has to – it's much easier with unicast streams.
Look, I'm not arguing that. I'm simply saying that it happens that cable companies do use multicast in the last hop. They don't use multicast at the center of the
No. I'm just becoming my perception of multicast is that its use case is dying away. The only one that really made sense was video or streaming radio, and no one listens to the radio or watches video at the same time. It's all on demand.
Okay, so the use case used to be, it was always teleconferences. Imagine that you want to have a conference with five people and they're scattered all over. You really don't want to send five, choose two possible connections so that you have a connection between every possible pair of recipients and senders. Instead, you'd like to have the minimum multicast tree so that somebody sends one copy down this tree and it only gets replicated as needed.
Yeah, but that's what a content delivery network does. I stream the content or I dispatch the content in a unicast network to the content delivery networking device at the edge of the network, and then it streams from there.
Yeah, but that's content delivery is ideal for offline stuff. That is to say, movies that you can stream them down unicast and then go from there, and they can cache it. The big thing that a content delivery network gives you is caching. With an online audio or video conference, you don't have caching. It's got to be delivered live because people are talking to one another.
I guess so. But when I use products like GoToMeeting or any of the other video conferencing platforms that I use, none of those use multicast and they work toot sweet.
No, they don't use multicast. The only question, the use case for multicast was it wastes a lot more bandwidth to do a bunch of unicast streams. If you did it all with multicast, it would be more efficient.
And that doesn't make sense in 2015 when bandwidth's cheaper than complexity.
Oh, wow. Is bandwidth cheap? Then why is my bill so high?
That's because you live in America. It's a regulatory problem. I'm living in the UK. I pay £50, which is roughly $75, $80 a month. That gives me 105 megabits down, 60 megabits up, and I get cable TV and a Netflix subscription included.
You better not tell people that or everybody will move to the UK.
And literally, it's a US problem. And same thing in other parts of the world. For example, in Australia, there's a problem there because the distance is nominally greater, so the costs are a little bit higher, but it's still cheaper to have internet in Australia than it is in America. In fact, just about anywhere in the world, it's cheaper to have internet than it is in the USA. So in Europe, it's even cheaper than here.
Well, you think it's regulatory. See, I think it's much more serious than that. For example, I just met somebody whose kids are in school and they are required to have internet access because they were talking about elementary school, you know, little kids, third grade. They are required to have internet access at home because the teacher gives all the assignments on a computer. And they are required to have cell phones, which makes no sense to me. Because the teacher wants to be able to send them things on cell phones.
So again, here in the UK, I pay $35 a month. I have unlimited data. I mean, unlimited, 24/7. I could run it on 4G, no questions asked. And then if I roam anywhere in Europe or the USA, I get 25 gigs a month.
Yeah, see, but what I'm saying, I think this is one of those economic situations. First, we require everybody to have internet access. We require everybody to have cell phones. And then, you know, the providers can just keep upping the prices because it's required. Well, people are going to pay.
And the thing
no
is that
what.
In America, they didn't deregulated their telecoms while handing over monopolistic powers to the carriers. But anyway, that's a different discussion. That's not the future of networking. But I mean, of all the countries where you look at the regulatory environments, the US has the least best model, as is evidenced by the prices that you pay, which could be a discussion for another day.
Let's take a break here to talk about today's show sponsor. Here on Packet Pushers, we've often talked about the evolving and sometimes confusing SD-WAN market, and today's sponsor, Telari, can bring clarification to that for you. Telari's been making WANs better for 8 years now and creating a thinking software-defined WAN that makes the network smart and responsive and, most importantly, it's able to adapt in real time to changing conditions. What's Telari's secret sauce? Only Telari's patented approach puts intelligence in every packet and at every endpoint. Now, the way they do this is that they do a true one-way measurement of every data packet coming and going. So if you think about that, right, you're actually transmitting and they're monitoring the packets between two devices in the transmit, and then separately they're managing the receive coming back the other way. Now, that means you can identify packet loss, jitter, and the failure of any one network path, and you can also cope with symmetric and asymmetric bandwidth. So if you're using broadband, you might have 10 meg down and 2 meg up. You need to have each way different. This allows you to use all of the network capacity to reroute packets and keep your data flowing no matter what. With Telari, mission-critical apps like VoIP and VDI take priority and always deliver, while less time-sensitive traffic like file backups or email fall in line and go at the right time. If you want to know more about how Telari's thinking software-defined WAN turns your bandwidth into brainwidth, upticking your uptime and freeing your own time to be brilliant, visit them at telari.com. And you can also find out more by listening to show 236, where we talk to the CTO and co-founder of Telari, John Dickey, about the technology. So if you want to get into the deep dives of how it works, Telari is a proven leading SD-WAN solution that started in the SD-WAN space before it was labeled as such. Go and check them out again at telari.com.
So let me move on very quickly. I wanted to talk a little bit about TCP/IP. Now, of course, you wrote three epic books on TCP/IP and internetworking with TCP/IP. And when I was many years ago, when I started to pick away at how TCP/IP worked, volume one was the one that I read from cover to cover a couple of times before I really started to get it in my head. And rather than talk to people about, you know, how TCP/IP works, which is probably the subject of that book, and go and do that, I wanted to ask you, where are the skeletons buried in that? Are we building up technical debt around TCP/IP? Is there something wrong with it that we should be aware of?
Well, you know, skeletons makes it sound like there's some horrible underlying thing. There were,
I've got to be
course,
a little bit dramatic to be some, interesting. Some, right?
There were, of course, some design decisions that didn't turn out so well. And I really dislike it when the old guys stand up and say, oh, you know, we made bad mistakes. You have to go back at the time. Remember, for example, that TCP and IP were separated into two protocols in 1978. That was the same year that Digital Equipment Corporation brought out their VAX computer, which was a departmental size computer. And it revolutionized things because it was so small. We had mainframes. And so classful addressing, that was fine for mainframes. It was even fine for departmental computers. It wasn't fine when we got down to the PC era and everybody wanted to have 1,000 networks. So we had to go to classless addressing. TOS bits. In those days, we had Telnet and FTP. Those were the two big uses of the internet. Well, throw in email with FTP, but FTP dominated email like crazy. So we had this low delay Telnet, which was, you know, the SSH style connections, and we had FTP transferring files. We needed high throughput. So we had TOS bits. Okay, they didn't hold up by the time you get to voice over IP. Yeah, I don't count that as a skeleton. I count that as just designed for the time. Same thing with EGP. I mentioned that BGP has transit policies. EGP, the original exterior gateway protocol, didn't have transit policies. That's because we didn't have ISPs. Believe it or not, there weren't. It was just us chickens. You connected to the internet because you were working on it.
It was your pipe from you to the neighboring university. Yeah.
Yeah. So, but now let's get to the stuff that are the really big mistakes, the ones that we're living with. We already mentioned multicast, sometimes called Deering multicast. That was a bad mistake, the way it was defined. IP mobility.
Oh, God, yes.
When was the last time you ever heard anyone using IP mobility?
I lost 6 months of my life to that. Being 2006, I spent 6 months on an IP mobility project at a service provider. What a miserable time that was. There was no happiness to be had.
Yeah, it was a terrible kludge of a design. And by the way, Lisp isn't much better. It does the same sorts of things that IP mobility tried to do.
Let me ask you a quick question on that, because I did a show with Dino Farinacci a few days ago on Lisp. The advantage of Lisp perhaps might be is that there was a lot of pain around IP mobility. I think it was fatally flawed in its design. But Lisp might be able to work better because compute power is greater and software is better. Is that a fair statement, or do you think it's fatally flawed in some way?
I don't think compute power has much to do with it. I think this is it's a question of what problem we're trying to solve. So here's the other alternative. The Lisp problem for mobility is trying to solve a problem where people retain endpoints. Why do you need to retain your endpoint address? You know, if you had asked me in 1978, I would have said, absolutely, I need my endpoint address. How else are you going to reach my computer? But now, people don't reach my computer. People don't have a computer that runs a server. Well, you know, a few people do, but in
not
general.
Many of us. Your average smartphone is not an endpoint, and it's, you know, I don't send traffic from blind. All connections from a smartphone are outbound at the start.
Exactly. So if everything is going to live in the cloud, then why do we need Lisp? The fact is, if everything lives in the cloud, we use that as the rendezvous point. All I need to be able to do is get to my cloud. I don't need to have anybody contact
and
me.
Well, Lisp does that by having the registration database in the cloud, or the, you know, where you register all the endpoint IDs.
Yeah. But the question is, why do I need to register the endpoint IDs in the first place? Why can't I just rely on cloud services to, you know, be the intermediary? For example, you know that we have Skype calls, and we don't have to have identifiable endpoint addresses. I don't have to run a server to receive a Skype call from you.
No, but there's a name server that matches my Skype name and your Skype name. So that's the cloud service that you're referring to.
Exactly. It's a cloud service in the middle. And so I think that's going to be the future. I think we're going to have more and more cloud services and fewer needs for, you know, identifiable endpoints running servers.
I think that'll apply for service providers, certainly, but I'm not sure that enterprises or even cloud providers will want to give away their personal or their unique information to others. And that might be where Lisp wins. So I may not have a WAN anymore. I may just be using the internet. But I might be able to use Lisp and, you know, various RLocks and so forth to be able to replace the WAN and get WAN-like properties.
Maybe. I'm not optimistic. I think the problem, it all boils down in the end to dollars. Can you solve the problem cheaper than replacing everybody's addressing and routing scheme with Lisp? And I think the answer is yes.
So the other part about Lisp is reducing the size of routing tables so that you can maintain your legacy assets for longer.
Yeah. Reducing the size of routing tables by aggregation. That's what
That's what MPLS does. I mean, the reason MPLS exists was the same reason.
We've always known that you can do aggregation and that aggregation is important. For anybody to come along and say, look, our stuff does aggregation and therefore it's better, Well, everybody's stuff is going to be doing aggregation. We already do it with IPv4. We'll do it with other things. So that's just a tick mark. You must do aggregation, but that doesn't mean you win.
Okay. What about QoS? Do you think we got QoS wrong in with TCP/IP? Or was it the best that we could do at the time and we still need to find an answer for it going forward?
Did we get it wrong? So here's one of those topics that is it's like the La Brea tar pits.
Yeah.
You know, you step in and you never step out.
Well, I remember the day I read the DiffServ RFC, and it basically said, and I followed back on the discussions and everything, and it basically said we couldn't get anybody to agree on a good QoS strategy, but DiffServ was the one that the least people objected to, or something to that effect.
Oh, no. So the IETF, let's go back in history. 1989, 90, somewhere around there, a bunch of people said, you know what's wrong with the internet? It's not as good as the telephone system. Guess who those people
were? Telephone
worked
system.
For? Yeah. The telephone companies. So the ITU and Bell Labs and all of those guys. In fact, you know, in the 80s, I used to visit Bell Labs a lot, and they would always criticize me for working on the internet. The internet is terrible. It's just a horrible technology. No one will ever use that. We know. Yeah. We built – they also had a phrase. We built the network with uppercase T. It was the only network in the world.
Yeah.
It was
and
their
network.
They owned
network. It too. They could – yeah.
They owned it, and they could tell you how to build networks, and nobody else knew. And so by the late 80s, people were saying, we ought to do – the same thing that we've done for audio for the internet. So all the phone companies got together and they built this thing called ATM.
Okay, I know where you're going now. Yeah.
It took a long time to define. So it came out in the sort of mid 90s. It was emerging. And they announced it with great pride. We are going to replace the internet. And it's going to have, our network will have quality of service. And if you look at what they defined for quality of service, from the outside, it actually looks really wonderful. They said, for example, you might want to have a voice call. A voice call needs 64 kilobits per second with no jitter. That's the quality of service that you would specify. And how do you get those numbers? 8,000 samples per second, 8 bits per sample. We know how to do this. On the other hand, you might want to send something like video. And so we're going to have another quality of service defined. It's going to be variable bit rate instead of constant bit rate. And the variable bit rate will let you send things at whatever rate the encoder sends. So if you look at video, there are different kinds of frames. There's a frame that gets sent with a full picture in it. And then there are differential frames that get sent after that. That have, you know, B frames and I frames that have differences between. So if you don't change the scene very much, you don't have to resend the entire scene. You just send the differences. And so that means that we're going to have these varying rates of sending with some parameters. And they defined a whole bunch of parameters. They went on and on and on.
I remember, And you created it, and each committed bit rate was a circuit, was meant to be a semi-permanent virtual circuit. So you'd make the call, the circuit would signal two ends, you'd agree that the band, and all elements in the path would agree to reserve the bandwidth.
Yes. And so now we're going to have quality of service. And then they set out to build all this stuff, and things went badly wrong. What went badly wrong? Well, first of all, it was extremely expensive. It was horribly expensive. That's because any system built with quality of service, turns out you have to have a hell of a lot of hardware. And you have to put in all sorts of intellectual property, and you have to put – it's not basic, simple stuff like an IP router. So at the time they were doing this, IP routers looked like, you know, small, and these guys were building these big, heavy – duty, quality of service things. But then they got to the hard part, the intellectually hard part. And that's the part where things fell apart. So they decided we're going to have all this quality of service, and then how are you going to manage it? Well, every element along the path has to watch everything that's going on to make sure that the quality of service that they agreed to is enforced. That means you have to do two things. Most important, you have to make sure that the data coming in on a given flow doesn't exceed what you expected it to do. And secondly, you have to never promise more capacity than you have. So you look at all the capacity in your device and all the outgoing lines, and you never promise, you never agree to another flow if you've used up all the capacity. Along comes a packet, and now what do you have to do? You have to figure out for this packet, what did I promise for this flow, and what have I seen? Let's take some simple case. Suppose you promised to give it 64 kilobits per second. I promise to give you 64 kilobits per second. You want to make sure that this flow coming in doesn't have more than 64 kilobits per second.
Yep.
Agreed? I mean, that's what it is.
So now you've got to count it on in. And you've got to hold state in the control plane for every circuit, because for every flow. And you've also got to have a database of flows and associated metadata with it about the commitments you've made around those flows. And then you've also got to be counting the egress bandwidth. But if you've got uncommitted bitrate circuits around that, you've got to reserve sufficient bandwidth for the uncommitted bitrate stuff. And if you're running VBR circuits, variable bitrate circuits, you may have to – you end up running it underloaded. I think if I remember rightly, we used to run them about 70% load.
Okay, so let's come back to that. But first of all, I want to talk about how hard it is to actually count. Remember what I told you about packets coming in at high speed and how many memory references you get? These guys said, not only are we going to do memory references to figure out what's in the packet, you know, what flow it came in on, and we have to do all that, we are going to compute floating point values. All of these things that we're talking about are done in floating point. We're going to figure out rates over the last second. Now, how do you figure it out when you're getting packets one at a time? How do you figure out how many packets came in on that flow over the last second? Yeah. You see the problem?
Well, and that's the problem we have with QoS today, same similar sort of thing. Although we use far less granular, we usually use access lists as a less granular thing, but yes.
All right, so that problem, that ATM problem, the IETF got worried about ATM taking over, and they formed this thing called InServe. InServe was going to be the IETF's answer to how to do quality of service. If they can do it, we can do it. So if the telephone guys figured it all out, we'll just do the same thing they did. The InServe group went off to figure out how to define this, how to build schedulers to do the output stuff, how to do policers to check the input. And they had the same problem that the ATM guys had. It's easy to specify all sorts of statistics. It's really hard to count, especially in a packet network, because now you don't just get packets all coming in on one line. It's not as if there's a wire and all I have to do is count how many packets you send me on your wire. If you're at the center of the internet, I'm getting random packets from various flows. So here's a packet. Now I have to take it, figure out which flow it goes to, and figure out when the last time was I saw a packet from that flow. And how do you do things like packets per second or bits per second, which is what the QoS guys want to do, when you get these packets at random intervals? You see what I'm saying? How far back do you keep a record? There's a huge database here.
And it rapidly becomes unsustainable. I mean, ATM collapsed under its own weight. It was never going to be possible. And I mean, you must remember too that in the old days with voice circuits, everything was a single circuit point to point, and data circuits were multi-point, and the amount of state they were talking about holding was just ridiculous. I'm reminded of RFC 1925, Rule 4, you know, some things in life can never be fully appreciated or understood unless experienced firsthand, and some things in networking can never be fully understood by someone who's neither built commercial operating equipment or runs an operational network, which I think is quite, that was really what happened here. Yeah.
Yes. So now the IETF realizes one day, we're not going to be able to do this. We have written a bunch of RFCs. We have spent a lot of research. There's the research community got involved. There's a zillion papers about how to do quality of service, but none of them talk about how to implement the actual counts. They all talk about what to count, algorithms, you know, fun stuff. And so now, what is the IETF going to do? That's where DiffServe yes. came from. They sat down at the table and said, well, we're not actually going to be able to do this for every TCP flow in the internet. How about if we just have broad classes? How about if we just say, for example, all of the high throughput traffic goes here, all of the low delay traffic goes there? We ought to be able to do that much. And that's what DiffServe is. That's why we have classes. And that's how we got to the current definition.
Yeah, I implemented InServe for a voice over IP network in the late in the mid-90s.
Yeah, it would have been the mid-90s.
And it was miserable. I remember implementing that in the mid-90s, and it was a miserable experience. I was on a 256K frame relay circuit. And when I was implementing InServe with voice calls, and we were using Companders running at 32 kilobits per second. So you can imagine that they wanted to have as many voice calls as possible. So with the maximum, we could sustain with 6. But at that point, the IP sessions would time out because there was no bandwidth left for the TCP IP and the IPX for that matter.
Yeah, it's so it's hard to implement. But now let me tell you going forward what the problem is. I get at least half a dozen times a year somebody who wanders into my office saying, we're looking, you know, some company, we're looking at quality of service in the internet. Don't you think that the internet is broken and needs to be replaced by something that has quality of service? And I tell them, let's start with the basics. One, really smart people have looked at this problem and failed.
Yeah.
So you better have something intellectual to offer that says you can do it.
Two, and it better have maths associated with it.
And two, that you have to think about the cost here, because one way to do quality service, and it's an easy way, is to make sure that you have so much excess capacity in the internet that you never need these silly counting algorithms and the quas schedulers, and you never actually depend on that. But of course, these guys all have stars in their eyes. And I get students the same thing. This week I had a PhD student walk in and say, you know, I think we could have a quality of service system where the internet runs at 99% capacity and we still get voice calls through and everything's fine.
Mm-hmm.
It's so easy to dream. I don't know why. Everybody that comes along dreams we're going to be able to do this and it ought to be easy.
I have only one way to solve QoS that I know is a guaranteed solution, and it works every single time. It's more bandwidth.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I would my advice to people is, and when it comes back to money, is by the time you get out there and invest money in buying QoS-ready hardware, and then you build a QoS policy and a QoS strategy, and you evaluate all the protocols that need to be, you know, which, and classify them into the different levels across your, and then you go out there and configure all the different devices in your network. And today we still have to use a CLI. So if you've got 1,000 nodes, each one of those 1,000 nodes is going to create probably 50 to 100 lines of configuration. So now you're talking about 100,000 lines of unique configuration per device that you have to manage. It would be much cheaper just to upgrade your entire backbone than to fix that problem.
Yeah. So let me tell you my analogy that I give to all of the people that want to do QoS. I tell them, let's go back and get rid of networking and think about something else. Let's go back to the early days of computers. In the old days, they were batch computers. Everybody put their jobs in, and there was a batch scheduler that figured out which job to run at which time. And everybody was really upset. They said, we don't have good scheduling algorithms to figure out how to optimize the throughput. We ought to have good scheduling out. So they worked for years. When I got to grad school, there were just books on how to schedule batch jobs, entire textbooks. And everybody was unhappy. Now let's go forward. By the mid 80s, maybe the 90s, all of those schedulers had been built. Nobody was happy with them, and they were really complex schedulers. In fact, the one that I really love is the TOPS 20 scheduler, which had two levels of pie slicing. You could tell the scheduler, each user gets a certain percentage of the CPU. So user one gets 20%, user two gets 10. You give them all those numbers. Mm. And then a user could say, in my 20%, I want to have three jobs running, and this one gets 3%, and this one gets 70%, and this one, and so forth. And the scheduling algorithm would sit there and figure out how to devote the CPU to all these jobs so that everybody got their assigned quality of service. Mm. All right, so now we flash forward to the 90s. Unix came along, and Unix said, hey, you know all that scheduling stuff? We're not going to do it. We're just going to go round robin. So you look at the Unix scheduler, it's one of the most stupid schedulers ever built. Everybody loved it. Why did people like the Unix scheduler when these really complicated, you know, schedulers to schedule algorithms and find a way to optimize things didn't work? I'll tell you, it's very simple. What happened? CPUs got fast. Mm. In between the 1970s, when CPUs were incredibly slow and everybody was trying to schedule, you know, 100% of the CPU so it was optimal, get to the 90s, the CPUs are so fast that nobody is running at 100% CPU utilization. Nobody.
Nobody's batching because there's always plenty of compute power around.
There's so much compute power around that you don't care. And that's been true again and again and again. We did it with scheduling database queries to disk. People spent years figuring out how to optimize database scheduling database queries, blah, 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 blah. And eventually, disks got so fast, and there was so much bandwidth to disks that now nobody cares. That's my answer. Whenever people talk about quality of service in the internet, oh, it'd be so great to have guaranteed quality of service. What they really mean is it would be so great to have so much capacity that I didn't have to worry about it.
And that's where we are, I think, with the internet today. Now, I know you said earlier that, you know, you would love to have high-speed internet at your house, but I think it is generally easier. So I recently moved from a house which had only 1 meg down and 256K up, and now I'm on 105 up and 105 down, 60 up, and my whole consumption pattern has changed. It was probably worth selling my house to get more bandwidth, to be honest.
Well, I have a very special connection because, you know, I've always worked on the internet projects, so I have a lease line from my office to my house, and it runs at 100 megabits in both directions.
I think we've probably done the TCP/IP question enough. I agree with your basic premise, which is TCP/IP has evolved over 30 years. I actually personally stand back in awe in the fact that, you know, 30 years later, it's still valid, it's still relevant, and it looks like it's going to go on for another 50 to 100 years, and there's no reason to believe that it's not going to last indefinitely. Admittedly, IP and TCP/IP or the TCP protocols are being stretched to the very limits. But my other view here is that the relevance of TCP/IP in the overall scheme of the internet is disappearing, in that the protocol stack that we built and have been so focused on is just being replaced by web browser HTTPS. Boom, we're kind of done. And aside from some minor protocol usage like SSH and DNS and so forth, NTP, 99% of the internet is HTTPS, and people are actually forgetting that TCP or IP is even underneath it. And I think most people are giving up on QoS search, certainly in the internet. So I agree with your perspective. What I wanted to do is move on and start talking more about software-defined networking as a movement. In the last 3 years, we've been talking extensively about software-defined networking and tracking how OpenFlow came to the market with the concept of flow-centric networking. And since then, all the vendors have leapt on top of it like seagulls on a bag of chips and started to, you know, try and extract a feast out of a little tiny bag of chips. And that this, now we're sort of moved through the early phase of trying to grab mindshare and float ideas and see which ones customers will be and where will the market go. And now the vendors are starting to ship products in the hope that they've got something there. So you've been doing research into networking for such a long time. What's your view of SDN as a movement so far? Are we, that is we, the industry and engineers like myself, I'd like to think of myself as an engineer, are we getting it right or wrong as we go forward, or are there things we should be thinking about?
Okay, so let me start by saying I am a researcher, mm-hmm. and everything I say has that flavor of research. In terms of SDN, if you look at a researcher and ask, how should things be done? Well, the answer is, A, you should do research first. Then, once the basic research is done, it's time to define a technology. And once the technology is defined, and by defining technology, I mean you standardize it, and you make decisions about trade-offs, engineering trade-offs, commercial trade-offs. And then finally, it's time to build commercial products. That was the way the internet was done. I just loved it. It was perfect. That's the way to build things. The SDN world has sort of proceeded the opposite way. One, there's commercial products. Two, let's form consortia and standardize some of these technologies
that we already invented.
And research got left out somehow. Now, the most interesting thing is the way this all got started. I was at Cisco. I was VP of research. So I was asked to go around and figure out what to fund. And I visited Stanford, and Nick McEwen was putting together this new thing, the OpenFlow stuff. And he was looking for five companies to help fund it. And so Cisco, I signed up, and Cisco was one of the first five to start funding it. And his pitch was wonderful. It was perfect. He said, what I want to do is get this stuff out there because this would be a perfect sandbox for researchers to play with to figure things out. And I want to put it in their hands, and this would be a great research testbed. And I said, perfect. I agree. This is wonderful. Mm-hmm. Within 2 years, companies were talking to me about OpenFlow products, and suddenly this whole idea of just using SDN as a research platform for researchers to fool around with and figure things out got lost. It turned into commercial very, very fast. I'm not blaming anybody. I'm just saying that happened. So from my perspective, it would have been much better to give this to the research community, let them think about it for a few years before we start building products. Now, in terms of what companies are doing, I think they're doing the easy part. The easy part, OpenFlow, defining a controller, defining the southbound interface between the controller and the device. I'm saying easy. Remember, I'm a PhD, so when I say easy, I don't mean trivial that anybody off the street can do it. I'm saying qualified people with a master's can do it. There's no intellectual research involved.
Well, it's usually fairly obvious, that stuff. Right, if this gear needs to fit to this gear, and the gears exist, you know what size of gear you need and what surface area. It's just doing the math to make sure the load and so forth. You know, to use a metaphor there that's not very good.
It's standard engineering. It's not some novel thing. But there is something novel going on in SDN that's really lost. You can't have a single controller control 1,000 devices. That's Doug Comer's statement of the SDN impossibility. Right. Now, people will argue, well, if there's not many changes and all you're doing is configuration and blah, 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 blah. Yeah, I know. But I'm saying in general.
So let me just drill into that for a sec. You're saying if you're in an open flow model, that is where you're manipulating every flow, you can't devolve to 1,000 devices? Or are you saying you can't have so most SDN controllers aren't intimately involved with the forwarding table. They're setting broad policy and devolving it to the device.
I'm saying if you're going to stick flows in tiny little detailed flows. Yes. You actually affect the TKM in every switch. By the time you get to 1,000 switches, if you have one physical controller, Open Daylight or whatever your favorite controller mm-hmm. is, if you have one, you have exceeded its capacity.
So that's the microflow model, as I see it, which is if you're going to micromanage the flows or micro-define every single flow, then that's not going to scale or is not going to be successful.
Well, all I'm saying is you can't do it with one controller. You need to replicate controllers. So, for example, if you have a campus and you have 1,000 devices on campus, you're going to need to replicate your controller and have multiple physical controllers all doing some subset of, so you have 10 controllers, they each do 1/10 of the devices. Mm. Okay.
Now you've got a federation problem.
That's the problem. The hard problem is now you need to coordinate all those controllers. It's the so-called east-west interface. How do you make controllers talk to one another? It's a distributed database problem. And it has one more feature that distributed databases don't have to deal with: timing. So in a distributed database, if I say I want this record to be propagated to all the databases, it is, and eventually it gets to all of them. But in a network configuration, it's really important not to do configuration piecemeal, because you can get routing loops, right? I change router 1 to go to a different path, but I haven't changed router 2. So router 2 thinks it's going back to router 1. Mm-hmm. Bingo, I get a routing loop.
Or even worse, I get cut off from one of the devices past the other one.
Or I get a black hole, or I get, so fill in all possible forwarding problems.
Yeah, routing loop is a general, it could be literally a loop, it could be a dropout, it could be a path mismatch, could be anything in there.
Yeah, it could be any of the above. So I have to be able to configure things all at the same time. Mm. Now I have a much harder problem than the distributed database people solve.
Right.
Okay, so we know it's a hard problem. We know people have developed three-phase commit protocols that can handle this, but there's a whole bunch of rules about synchronized clocks. So we need clock synchronization. We need three-phase commit. So now suddenly we have what I consider to be a massive intellectual problem. How do you run all of this stuff so that you can guarantee simultaneous update of all of the flow tables?
Okay, so that's the microflow model. What about a megaflow model? So I look at routing protocols like BGP and OSPF, and they're actually loading megaflows into the FIB. That is, any source going to this destination matching any flows matching that destination IP address from any source with any TCP port, blah, blah, blah. That's a megaflow model. We can solve that with routing protocols today. Could we solve that with an SDN controller in theory?
We solve it with routing protocols today with a whole bunch of caveats. For example, RIP. Yep. RIP has a horrible problem if you take out the split horizon and poison reverse parts. Mm-hmm. Those were put in long after RIP was built, because we had this terrible problem of backwash of bad information. You know about it? You know what happened?
Split horizon, and same thing with EIGRP.
We had
all sorts of problems where, of course, once we had split horizon, then we had all the different types of frame relay. So if you're using PVCs and SVCs and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, so now we know we can put those kinds of heuristics into protocols, but we've got to add that to the protocols we use for the east-west interface. So we've got clock synchronization, distributed database. We've got the problem of things like split horizon or the equivalent kinds of heuristics. We've got to roll those all together and come up with protocols that let the SDN controllers coordinate. Is that an easy problem? No, absolutely not. That is a really hard intellectual problem.
And that's science, right? That's not just hack something together and get it to go. That's actually real science.
That's real science. We haven't thought about this yet. I mean, it was like the early days of RIP, the first time that we ended up with a routing loop in RIP. Somebody said, you know, we just found these two routers had formed a routing loop. Well, aren't they running RIP? Yes. Well, then that can't happen. I mean, we just, you know.
And then someone worked it out and they went, we didn't think of that.
It took a long time to actually trace down what was happening and why we needed those heuristics like split horizon. It was so amazing. And I think that's what's going to go wrong with SDN. We're going to end up building these east-west interfaces to coordinate multiple controllers. And then people are going to realize, oh, guess what? We didn't think about timing, or we didn't think about what happens if we give a policy to this BGP router and don't give the same policy to our other edge BGP router at the same time.
So you would then point to things like BGP and say, we know the limitations of the existing protocols we have today, like BGP. We recognize and what its limitations are, and that which can be fixed with hacks like split horizon in the RIP case and poison reverse and so forth. We've solved those problems over the years. So BGP is known as it is, and SDN, there's still something missing?
Well, BGP is known as it is, and in addition to running BGP, people run watchdogs on BGP to make sure they know what to look for. They know these anomalies can occur, and they run watchdogs to watch BGP to make sure that it's doing its job correctly. So we've actually built sort of little, I don't know if you want to think of it as a hack, but we've built little watchdog devices that, yes, enhancements.
Optimizations.
They avoid some of the pitfalls of BGP. Mm. And we're not even close to identifying the pitfalls for the SDN coordinating controller east-west stuff. So we can't even begin to build the watchdogs. Mm.
And I guess this is why standards hasn't emerged in the SDN space, because these problems aren't exposed and in the open, you know, exposed for everybody to see and maybe not even experienced yet to need solutions.
Right. So that's the first part. The second part, by the way, is people have no idea what they're going to do with SDN. It started out that what they really wanted to do was save money on configuration and management. That was pretty simple. We are going to use software instead of people to configure routers. And I've heard these numbers. You know, how many devices does a typical IT person manage today? Mm. Oh, they can manage up to whatever, you know, your company has. Every company has.
Enterprise is running 100 servers to one. Server admin, cloud companies are running 1,000 to one, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah. And so now the promise of SDN was you run 100 or somewhere between 50 and 100 servers to a technical person, you'll be able to run 1,000. We'll be able to go up by an order of magnitude. Think about the savings and cost when you fire all those guys who are now managing your servers. Of course, that's a nice little dream. That's not a scientific statement of requirements. That's a dream. How do you get there? That's the other part of SDN. Everybody is proposing, well, maybe if you do this, you can get to that. Maybe if you do this, you can get to that. One of my favorite thoughts was I was at an SDN conference and I was listening to how SDN was going to automate configuration of BGP and firewalls. And it was basically, we are going to have software take a policy, replicate it, reformat it in all the appropriate things, and then stuff it down into every occurrence of BGP and every firewall around the company. And I thought of the old Rube Goldberg cartoon about automatic transmissions. You've probably seen it. The automatic transmission is when this funny arm reaches up from the floor of the car and moves the gear shift. Mm. Right. It was in the days when they had manual transmissions and you had to move the gear shift lever. And so this little automated arm would reach up and do the job for you. And that's what I thought, that what these guys are really doing here is they have just automated what we used to call scripting. Right. Yeah. And if you're in a big enterprise now, you know that you write scripts that go download the same configuration file into all your routers. You don't do it by actually typing. You just run these scripts. So somebody types in a script, downloads it, presses a button, and then all these copies get downloaded. And that's the sort of picture I had. That, as a as an SDN paradigm, is terribly flawed. We shouldn't be figuring out how to do what the manual, you know, text job does now with software. We should be figuring out what new paradigm can we use rather than how to do the old stuff a new way.
So let me just take an oppositional model to you just to promote the discussion here a little bit, which is somewhat aligned to my current perspective. So what I like about OpenFlow is this concept of managing flows, because ultimately every single networking device has a flow table in it. True?
If you just mean classification as a paradigm instead of demultiplexing, yes. Everybody can use classification, and the highest speed hardware uses classification. And you can build classification tables in TCAM. And in that sense, everybody can indeed use that same paradigm. But that's entirely different than saying we're doing everything with flows, because classification lets you do what we do right now with IP addresses. You don't have to have anything lower than an IP address.
Okay, let me unpack that because I think I might have missed it. So I'm saying that flow states in the network are represented in the FIB. You're calling that a classification. So you're saying I receive a packet from the input phase, I identify, I match the packet against the FIB table or classify, and then define its output port and it leaves the device.
All right. Let's draw back. In fact, I recommend you read the latest edition of my book. You can find out about what classification is and what we're talking about here. So classification is a technique where you look at multiple layers of the protocol stack at the same time by taking a packet. Think of it as an array of bits in memory, and now you are free to look at, the classifier can look at the Ethernet type. It can look at the protocol field in the IP header. It can look at protocol port numbers in the TCP header all at once. So that's what a classifier does in the typical switch or router paradigm where we have. That's a hardware device, usually done in TCAM, very fast. So the classification paradigm is in contrast to the old demultiplexing paradigm, where in the demultiplexing paradigm, you suck in a frame, you look at the type, depending on the type, you pass that off to a module, a software module. Maybe it's the IP module, the ARP module, so forth. So instead of looking one layer at a time, having one module for every layer, you look at everything all at once. And in that sense, SDN controls classification tables, and because it's controlling classification tables, it can do anything that you can do now with IP routing, anything you can do now with MPLS, anything you can do now with layer two forwarding mechanisms.
Yeah, any.
It gives you a lot of flexibility.
Yeah. Or any future protocol, because you're matching bits, not.
Yep. So as long as you were talking about classification, yes, everybody can use it, and it can replace what we're doing now.
And SDN programming that FIB is what I generally regard as SDN, however you do it, right? Whether you're using OpenFlow or NetConf or programming a vendor's CLI or injecting static routes into BGP or ISIS, that is, to me, is all about programming the FIB using megaflows.
But now we get to this part where people are doing SDN and they're saying, here's what I'm going to do. My SDN box is going to configure BGP. And in fact, they are not configuring a classification table at all. What they're doing is they are actually taking a real standard old-fashioned BGP configuration and pushing it into a BGP running device. So it's nothing to do with what we just talked about with classification. It's nothing to do with flows. It's real standard old-fashioned configuration.
It's not an innovation. It's just doing it the same old way we've always done it.
Yeah, and so I'm always puzzled when they say, this is SDN and we've never done anything like this. I ask them, what was SNMP?
Awful.
Couldn't you have?
Sorry.
Be scientific for a minute. Don't be so pejorative. Take a look at it scientifically.
Yes.
From a scientist's point
of view, it was nearly perfect.
A manager could use SNMP to change IP forwarding, to change BGP configuration, to change all that stuff.
Yes.
Agreed?
Well, in theory,
And now, now if you do that with a funny kind of SDN controller and say that we're really doing a controller, it's the same thing. Different protocol, different way to speak to a device. So we're not using SNMP, but we're using a different, you know, protocol to speak to the device, but it's the same thing. So it's not a real advance.
Well, the reason that SNMP failed was because SNMP wasn't a very good API. It didn't do, multiple phase commit. It didn't confirm. The data richness wasn't there, things like that.
Well, you know how SNMP ended up being a disaster, right?
I'd rather hear your version of it than mine.
SNMP was proposed by, actually, a new configuration protocol, network configuration protocol, was proposed by an ITF working group, and they started. Meanwhile, the ISO folks had formed the OSI protocols, and there was this sort of political statement that the IETF was being elitist. We needed to look at what was in the rest of the world. We needed to be more open to have others involved. And so as a compromise, the SNMP folks didn't want to adopt everything in ISO, but they agreed to do ASN.1. They agreed to do, the basic FIB or the basic MIB, structure as a SNMP database defined in everything defined in terms of ASN.1, including the line representation, which was absolutely bizarre and horrid, on the wire. So politically, they agreed to all of that, and then they started defining MIB items, and they hoped that they would have been able to overcome the little compromise. But they were lost in this horrible world of ASN.1.
Which is a pure computer science thing. Just not very practical in real life.
No, it wasn't. It's one of those things where people come along and say, I can do naming. I know how to do all of that stuff. It's easy. And the worst people in the world are the people who look and say, oh, this is trivial, and run off and define something slipshod. The best people looked at it and said, this is really hard. We'll have to think about this for years to get it right. and they were right. That was true. You can't define something elegant and simple and beautiful just by throwing things together. So ASN.1 is a typical committee design. It's got everything in it.
It was all very fashionable in its day. So the idea behind ASN.1 was that it was backed up by a bunch of research computer scientists saying this was a definitive data representation language.
Yeah, well, as I say, Sturgeon's Law applies to research.
Okay. I'll have to put a link for Sturgeon's Law in the
You know what Sturgeon's Law is?
Oh, 90% of everything is crap.
Yes. And when it comes to research, Sturgeon was an optimist.
Because, there's a couple of things in there. One of the things is you were saying, I remember in the late 90s we all used to write Perl scripts to program SNMP, and particularly with the Bain Networks routers of the day, and before them, the Wellfleets, right? Because everything was SNMP and those things, and you could write Perl scripts. And the challenge was, of course, is that when we used SNMP, it wasn't it was not easy and it wasn't very predictable. I won't say reliable because actually some parts of it were reliable, but there was no guarantee that if you did a specific thing, it would always do that. It would always get you the same outcome. Now, whether that was a vagary of SNMP or the vendor changing their MIBs or the vendor code not being very stable between releases, predictability is all forms of that, yes. Right? And there's a couple of things. One is, you know, they talk about NetOps now, you know, using software to defined infrastructure and programming and programmable infrastructure and all that, is, to my mind, is just a hark back to the mid-90s when that's what we used to do.
Yeah. Everything and in networking is old. We've been through it all once. So
RFC 1925, once again. Every old idea will be come around again as a new idea and be re-implemented regardless of whether it was a good idea.
Yeah, with a new name. All you need is a new name and suddenly things.
I'll quote it, Rule 11, every old idea will be proposed again with a different name and a different presentation, regardless of whether it works.
Yeah, especially if it failed the first time. If it was successful the first time, everybody just used it and we're done. So if it failed the first time, then it'll get proposed again under a new name.
Wait 10 years and give it another go. Yep. Or there'll be a PhD student coming to talk to you and say, I found this great technology, we should try it again.
Yes.
I think we've taken the discussion just about as far as we can go today. We're running at about 90 minutes, and I think this is as far as we can go in a single session. So I'd like to thank Doug Comer for coming on the show today. Doug, where can people find you on the internet?
They can find me at where can they find me? The easiest thing to do is to look at the computer science department at Purdue and find me on the web there. But you can write to me as comer@purdue.edu, purdue.edu, and I'll be happy to talk to them.
And I'm Greg Farrow. This is the Packet Pushers. I've had a great discussion today with Doug Comer talking about the future of networking, and we have a couple of more topics that we are going to talk about, and we will plan to talk again in the future. This is your chance to participate. If you've got an idea or a topic that you'd like me to discuss in the next show, please leave comments on the show notes. I've put a bunch of links, and there'll be a link to Doug's website at purdue.edu. You can pretty much find it by just Googling Douglas Comer, C-O-M-E-R, at any time. And if you've got questions you'd like to ask him, now we can talk about ancient history, we can talk about modern history, and we can talk about where things are going to go from here and get his input. And this is a series first or in a series of shows where I'm going to be talking with notable figures about the future of networking and having discussions like we've had today, because this has really been a really fine discussion. I personally believe that looking at the history of networking will always tell you where the future of networking goes. As always, this has been the Packet Pushers. You can leave comments and feedback on the show notes, and we would be delighted to hear from you. You can follow the Packet Pushers on @PacketPushers, and don't forget to send us email with your thoughts or personal opinions. If you can't publish things in public, you can contact me by simply writing to me, packetpushers@gmail.com. And as always, remember that too much networking would never be enough.